Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. My name is the Reverend Renee Rahutsky. I am the affiliated community minister for this congregation. Our parish minister, the Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zemer, is tending to her new baby, and she'll be back after the holidays.
If we have any hope of transforming the world and changing ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort, brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and others. May we, as a people of faith, be granted the strength to be so bold, so brave, and so loving. Joseph M. Cherry.
Is not in service at this time. Please check your number or try your call again.
From the fragmented world of our everyday lives, we gather together in search of wholeness. By many cares and preoccupations, by diverse and selfish aims, are we separated from one another and divided within ourselves. Yet we know that no branch is utterly severed from the tree of life that sustains us all. We cherish our oneness with those around us and the countless generations that have gone before us. We would hold fast to all the good we inherit, even as we would leave behind the outworn and the false. We would escape from bondage, from the ideas of our own day, and from the delusions of our own fancy. Let us labor in hope for the dawning of a new day without hatred, violence, and injustice. Let us nurture the growth in our own lives of the love that has shone in the lives of the greatest men and women, the rays of whose lamps still illumine our way. In this spirit, we gather and pray. Come, let us worship together.
Our wisdom words this morning, you can leave the lights on, it's okay. Our wisdom words this morning are from Robert Walsh. Did you ever think there might be a fault line passing underneath your living room, a place in which your life is lived in meeting and in separating, wondering and telling, unaware that just beneath you is the unseen seam of great plates that strain through time, and that your life, already spilling over the brim, could be invaded, set off in a new direction, turned aside by forces you were warned about, but not prepared for. Shelves could be spilled out, the level floor set at an angle in some seconds shaking. You would have to take your losses, do whatever must be done next. When the great plates slip and the earth shivers, and the flaw is seen to lie in what you trusted most, look not to more solidity, to weighty slabs of concrete poured, or strength of cantilevered beam, to save the fractured order. Trust more the tensile strands of love that bend and stretch to hold you in the web of life that's often torn, but always healing. There's your strength, the shifting plates, the rest of earth, your room, your precious life, they all proceed from love, the ground on which we walk together. Let us now share a few moments of silence together. Spirit of life and love, spirit of mystery, some days life can feel like a real burden. We have cares, concerns, challenges. And yet, there's the beauty of the sunrise, the turning of the leaves, the brisk air, the warm rain, the gentle touch of a child. The soft voice of an elder. The fullness of it. Help us to be present, hearts open. Amen, and blessed be. Reflection this morning where we're going to represent kind of three generations and how things have changed over time. Hal is going to be our elder very graciously. He's agreed to be our elder. I get to be myself, and so does Sophie. So So generational theory reminds us that what is happening in the greater world affects each generation. We want to spend a few moments reflecting on the kinds of changes that technology and our culture has been experienced over these three different generations. So Hal will start.
If you wanted to talk to someone, you walk over to their home and chat across the fence. You'd write letters to folks who lived far away. If there was urgent news, you could always go down to the Western Union office and send a telegram.
My family had a landline with a rotary dial phone because it was less expensive. Long-distance calls were expensive, but you could save money if you called late in the evening or on weekends. If you traveled and you were in trouble, you could always find a payphone. They were everywhere. Now, for high-powered businessmen and rich people, they had these new things called car phones.
When I was young, I had a track phone, which only held 10 numbers and 911. And then my mom had a BlackBerry, and I always loved to take it and play Tetris. But now there's the iPhone, which has a UU app, by the way, and it can surf the web anywhere except for in the mountains.
We had so many options when it came to music. Bands would travel all over and perform at concerts and dance halls. We could listen to music on the radio or on our record players, and we could always make our own music.
I started out listening to AM radio and buying 45s. Then, once I started listening to album-oriented rock stations, I would buy LPs and cassette tapes. I even had an 8-track player in my old car. Then MTV came along, and I was exposed to all sorts of new artists. Then compact discs came out, and I started buying all of my music on CD.
When I was little, I had a hip clip, which held about 5 songs, and I could take anywhere and just put it right on my hip and just hum along to it. But then came the iPod, which a lot of kids had when they were little and lost and then got the new version. And then came YouTube, which most music artists now use to put out music videos, and a lot of different communities have come up inside the YouTube world.
Most of our entertainment was vaudeville or the theater. We also had movies that were black and white, and instead of voices, had written captions and a live organ player playing along to the film. Eventually, they invented films where the actors could talk and sing.
We started out with a black and white television, but eventually splurged on a color TV set. It was all broadcast television. Cable TV was not available where I lived. Occasionally, we went out to the movies, but we preferred the drive-in because it was cheaper and we could pack our own snacks.
Nowadays, people have 64-inch televisions and can have their own movie party at their house in 3D. It used to be the glasses with the red and blue blocks, but now you can get them in clear. And there's the 3D IMAX theaters where you can sit and look straight up and see the entire roof is a movie.
Sharing your thoughts was as easy as writing in a letter or a journal. A wonderful invention was the cartridge pen. No more dipping a quill into an inkwell. If you had the money, you could invest in a typewriter to speed up the process. If you wanted to make a lot of copies of something, there was a handy invention called the mimeograph machine, where you could create a stencil of your document, then run off a few dozen copies.
We had some minor improvements to the tools we used to share our thoughts. We had ballpoint pens that you could just throw out when the ink ran out. IBM came out with a fancy electric typewriter called the Selectric, which in newer models had a correction ribbon where you could correct a mistake with hardly even noticing the correction. Big companies had word processing machines where specially trained operators could create documents and store them electronically. Then something amazing happened. We bought a personal computer where we could create and store documents on these big, thin, floppy disks and then print them on a dot matrix printer. We could make copies of the disks and share them with others. We could buy special dictionary software and check our spelling. We had to buy special paper to work with the tractor feed on the printer, though. But we could print as many copies as we wanted.
We have Google Docs now that allows us to work on the same, multiple people to work on the same document with not being in the same room or even in the same country. And also we have autocorrect, which can save us and or embarrass us.
We had lots of opportunities to interact with our neighbors and friends. We might meet them at the pub or the barber shop. There were always the regulars, but there were new people now and then. Sometimes there would be town hall meetings to make decisions about our community, or we could just hang out on the front porch and shoot the breeze.
Since I lived in the suburbs, there weren't really any regular gathering places, but I could call my friends on the phone and plan get-togethers with the usual folks.
Now you can plan instantaneous get-togethers by texting or calling, and or if you're in different countries or different cities, you can do FaceTime and or Skype.
Awesome. So that's our little trip through time. So my family has always had music be a part of their lives. My maternal grandfather was a wonderful singer and always sang around the house. My mother inherited that from him, as did I. We still do that around my house. My kids are very embarrassed, but my paternal grandfather played the accordion, mostly polka music from the old country. During the good years, my grandparents bought things that would play pre-recorded music. They had a Victor Victrola, a wind-up photograph that played 78 records, and they bought, you know, cabinet stereos and all those sorts of things. And when I was little, my parents bought me a record player that played the little 7-inch singles. My dad had a transistor radio that was solid state, could run on batteries, and had a single little earpiece that you could use instead of the speaker. In the 70s, I had a boombox. It was a mini stereo that played both radio and cassettes. Then in the 1980s, my cousin visited from Germany and showed off her brand new Sony Walkman. It had no speaker at all, but it did have lightweight stereo headphones. In a few years, the price came down and I bought one. Around this time, my husband, then husband and I, put together a nice stereo system with different components and good speakers that provided a satisfactory experience for his audiophile ears. Then, of course, compact discs came out and so on and so on. Over and over, again and again, I am challenged to learn some new technology, new at least to me. Now, I'm not one who resists new things. In fact, I kind of like getting a new gadget and figuring out how it works and how it can be used to make my life better in some way. But if I feel under pressure to have to learn something new really quickly, it can be really overwhelming. I also realize there are people who don't really care for new technology at all and resist having to learn something new and feel frustrated when they don't have a choice. And then there are lots of people in between, in the spectrum between Luddite and geek. But no matter what our feelings about technology and how much we use it, it has an effect on the way we live our lives and how subsequent generations are going to live in the world. Part of this is the invention of how new gadgets make old gadgets obsolete. But much of this technology has already, in fact, affected the very way we perceive and interact with the world, and it will continue to do so. There have been a slew of books about how the internet, iPads, smartphones, and other new technologies are rewiring our brains, and not always in a good way. You can tell by their titles: The Flickering Mind, Distracted, and The Shallows. The Lady Gaga song that our youth choir sang reflects the expectation that we can be available 24/7 because of our mobile phones. Now, we used to believe that our brain, the adult brain, was fixed, that once a human had reached adulthood, it was difficult to make any great changes in behavior, attitude, or personality. But we now know that human brains can and do change, but in a different way than the brains of children. In the book, The Shallows, our author, Nicholas Carr, tells the story of Friedrich Nietzsche, who had a medical condition that required him to switch to a typewriter. soon after its invention. What's interesting is how his writing style changed and reflect a new forcefulness that was not present when he was writing by hand. More recently, we have seen a shift in writing styles towards shorter and terser sentences as email has eclipsed letter writing as a major method of communication. Today, many people, including myself, use text or instant messaging, and even Twitter, which has clipped writing even further to fit into the 140-character format. Our human relationships with each other have also shifted as the technology has shifted. Music used to be more of a participatory pastime, as Hal pointed out, with family and friends gathering around a piano or other musical instrument to sing together. With the advent of recorded music, the emphasis moved toward performance and perfection, with less participation and more listening as a musical pastime. Then, as the personal stereo became popular, listening to music became an individual rather than a group activity, as each person was now able to select a personal soundtrack as he or she goes about her daily business. The first Sony Walkman had a dual headphone option so that you and a friend could listen at the same time, but that option turned out to be much less popular than the solitary option, so Sony discontinued it. There has also been a recent development in the world of music during the past couple of decades that's a cause for concern. Every decade or era of music in the past century has had its own unique genre that had its own characteristic or flavor. Every decade since the late 90s, that is when the current method of the usage of the internet, known as Web 2.0, came into being. This is the internet of YouTube and Facebook, of blogs and Twitter, of Skype and of smartphones with video cameras, and of cheap and easy software to create personal recordings or videos, such as the one we saw earlier today. There is a term called mashup that describes the process of taking other people's music, video, or artwork, I had Hal's music and Brad's photographs, to create a new piece, which was a video, to create seemingly endless new artworks and pieces. One way this mashup technique was popularized was in hip-hop music, which would take riffs from other songs and remix them into a new song with some added lyrics or music. Because it was derived from an earlier work, part of its meaning came from the meanings that were associated with the original sample of music. Other ways of deriving new works from old are remakes of old classic TV shows or movies, or a popular technique in children's movies, to put in a cultural reference for the adults watching the film that is meant to go over the youngsters' heads. I think of some of the jokes that show up in the Shrek movies, for those of you who've seen them. I have mixed feelings about many, if not most, of these derivative works. Because they play off things that are already familiar to me, a tune or an image, they have easy access to my emotions through the limbic part of my brain, the part with a strong emotional component. That makes them both enjoyable and a little bit manipulative. So part of the living tradition of our Unitarian Universalist faith is our humanism. We often talk about humanism in the context of a belief system that is grounded in reason and science. But there is another facet to being a humanist, and that is the desire to realize our full potential, to be fully human in all of our marvelous creativity and capacity. Computers are our creations, and they do some marvelous things. But they fall short, at least so far, of the nuanced gifts that we human creatures are blessed with. Digital music does not have the same texture as music that is played on real instruments. Even computer graphics with the largest color palette are unable to compare with the vibrancy of an oil painting. Even the best acting on film doesn't have the same effect on us as the immediacy of a live actor's performance. The nuances of body language and facial expression become flatter on film and even flatter on digital video formats such as Skype or YouTube. Computer scientist Jaron Lanier, one of the pioneers of virtual reality, wrote a humanist manifesto called You Are Not a Gadget, in which he cautions that much of our new technology is flattening our culture in a way similar to the Cultural Revolution in China. The Maoists there repressed intellect and creativity by trying to reduce culture to the lowest common denominator. Even though we theoretically have access to more information, we can also pick and choose what we access. So we can limit ourselves to ideas or opinions that we are comfortable with or that corporations want to see based on our internet profiles. The anonymity of the internet also makes bad behavior between people easier. There's even a whole new slang to describe it. People flame each other when they post something mean, and mean people on the internet are referred to as trolls. Lanier cautions against the collective hive mind created by certain uses of the internet, such as Wikipedia. His concerns are that with such collective endeavors, we lose touch with the real author of original information, and it also creates a false sense of authority behind the information. He also worries that collective authorship tends to favor the mainstream and reinforce oppressions, or might be manipulated behind the scene by those with an agenda and no visible responsibility. 80 years ago, Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a book called Moral Man and Immoral Society in response to the pragmatic philosophy of one of my heroes, John Dewey. Dewey envisioned a world where our interactions with one another enriched us, but Niebuhr cautioned that our moral agency resides in the individual and becomes lost whenever we become part of a collective. Niebuhr's position was reinforced when we saw the dark side of what can happen in a collective in both Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. We have also seen the lack of morality in other collective bodies, especially in for-profit corporations. I personally believe that our Supreme Court was mistaken when they gave corporations protections as persons under the 14th Amendment back in 1886, and again in the Citizens United decision back in 2010. Corporations are no longer held responsible for their decisions as a whole, and they're no longer restricted in spending to influence our political elections. So corporations enjoy protections and privileges that were normally afforded to individuals, but individuals within the corporations are not held responsible for their decisions that drive the corporation's actions. So the good news is that individuals can band together as moral agents using the new technology. There's a book called Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organization by Clay Sharkey, and he shares dozens of examples. Social media such as Facebook and Twitter helped to fuel the Arab Spring and the Occupy Wall Street movement. The ability to blog and share information widely also helped to unite activist Catholics who were trying to hold the bishops accountable for reassigning priests accused of sexual abuse. That group, called Voice of the Faithful, was having a hard time organizing because, for some odd reason, they weren't allowed to access meeting space in the churches where they were members or use newsletters or things like that. But once they were able to use social media, the activists were able to compare notes from different dioceses and uncover the patterns of abuse and reassignment. And of course, thanks to Edward Snowden, we also know that with all of this technology, it can also be used to invade our privacy and is actually doing so. So when I think about the lure, because I love gadgets, the lure of new technology, I turn back to an old source, the Hebrew scriptures, from the book of Genesis, where it states, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Do not have any strange gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents, to the third and fourth generations of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. So for me, translating a lot, the metaphor of God is that which is above and beyond my highest aspiration of goodness and love. And I must not mistake any one manifestation for the ideal. My own love of my fellow humans must be steadfast, for it is in my relationship with you that informs my relationship with the sacred. And I just love that Karen found that children's story. It's just kind of the theme of this sermon encapsulated in it with lovely illustrations. So a gadget can be a tool. It can be a distraction. It can also be used to enhance our relationships, or it can become an idol that overshadows them. So let us remember the gifts we are given in our humanity. May we use our gifts in ways that continue to co-create and enrich the universe. Amen, and blessed be. In reality, there's nothing anyone can give us. There's nothing we lack.
Each of us is perfect and complete, lacking nothing, but this truth must be realized by each one of us.
Great faith, great doubt, and great determination are the essentials for that realization. Amen and blessed be.